architecture has remained as a testimony to the pioneering effort, to the spirit of the Muscovite state as it was taking shape. And you have to remember that these monasteries that offer so much in terms of architectural history were founded by people who precisely wanted to be in a harsh and severe environment as a part of the test of their faith.
Architectural photographer William Brumfield, he'll be back in just a moment with more about his new book, Lost Russia, a pictorial account of the ruins of Russian architecture. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light. We keep the lights on and more. Even though the Soviet Empire has collapsed, Russia continues to hold the attention of Western policymakers and the press. But up to now, the objects of that attention have been largely political and economic. Recently, however, in the search for fresh perspectives, Western thinking about Russia has increasingly turned to cultural considerations. Listen now as two leading scholars reflect on some of these important but heretofore neglected dimensions of Russian history. First on Soundings this week, William Brumfield will talk about his new book, Lost Russia, Photographing the Ruins of Russian Architecture. After that, historian Louise McReynolds will discuss the rise of the Russian middle class in the years before the Revolution of 1917. William Brumfield is a professor of Slavic studies at Tulane University. Last January, his photographs of the ruins of Russian churches were part of a major exhibition at the Duke University Museum of Art. I asked William Brumfield to talk about his work in the context of Russia's political transformation since the early 1990s.
Well, I think one of the signal moments of that transformation, which is very complicated and at times seems chaotic to outside observers, but one of the signal moments is the reconstruction of the Cathedral of Christ the Redeemer in central Moscow. This was the largest church in Moscow. It was built in the middle of the 19th century as a memorial to Russian sacrifices in the 1812 war against Napoleon. In 1931, at the order of Stalin and his associates, the church was dynamited, the rubble cleared in order to build a new Palace of Soviets, as it was called, intended to be the tallest building in the world at that time. It was a calculated move to symbolize the dethroning of religion and the order that they associated with religion in the pre-revolutionary period. It was a trauma that lasted in Russian society until the present. In other words, here was a national shrine that was calculatedly barbarously destroyed.
Give our listeners, Bill Brumfield, a sense of what this cathedral is like. I mean, apples and oranges when we speak about St. Peter's, all of that sort of thing.
Well, I think in its central volume, it would rival the size of St. Peter's. It doesn't have the colonnade and many of the ancillary structures, but it was a huge presence on the Moscow skyline, particularly in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Rivaled the Kremlin itself as a focal point at the city's center. Its destruction immediately left a huge gap that reminded everyone of the plans and designs of this regime, which was ruthlessly determined to erase the old order and put in its own version.
And you say that as it reconstructs itself, as it's going up on the cityscape of Moscow in the 1990s, it dwarfs the buildings around it.
Yes, it still does. The decision to rebuild the church was not taken seriously by many people at the beginning of the 1990s. There were collection boxes around the city, but one never knew how long it would take to get the money. What we didn't understand was that this was not a simple preservation issue of restoring an architectural landmark, but was yet another political gesture on the part of the new order.
And in what way? I mean, how?
Well, rebuilding this church would symbolize, as nothing else, the rejection of the Marxist, Leninist, Stalinist order, and specifically its attack on religion and national values associated with Orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. So that it's a rather complicated phenomenon with many ramifications, but when the foundation work was actually undertaken, people realized that there was a very serious impetus behind this. I should say that the Palace of Soviets that was intended for this site never was built. It was simply unrealistic. The Second World War intervened. And during the Khrushchev era, building site was turned into the largest outside swimming pool in the world, a heated swimming pool that released vast amounts of water vapor in the winter and indeed threatened some of the art collections at the Pushkin Museum two blocks away. Uh-huh. So vast was the microclimate created by this pool. Well, the pool was closed, and I remember that, in the early 90s, and then a small chapel was built on the site to symbolize its reclamation by the church, and then suddenly an enormous construction site took shape, and the building has arisen out of the ground with remarkable speed.
Now, Bill, you are an art historian. You are not a theologian. I don't mean to put you on the spot and ask you to talk about spirituality as such, but in addition to the political implications mm-hmm. and impetus behind the reconstruction of this immense cathedral in Moscow, comment briefly on belief, spirituality. I mean, should we look at it in those terms at all?
Well, I think we have to. The church is not only a political gesture, and it certainly is that, because one of the major backers of the church is the current mayor of Moscow, Lushkov, who sees this as a part of his campaign to reconstruct the city in the central city in preparation for the 850th anniversary of Moscow, which will be in 1997. So there are a number of projects. This is the most visible in the central city. But yes, it also involves very directly the Russian Orthodox Church. My interpretation here is that a structure of similar size would have been built regardless of the historical setting that I've just described to you. The Russian Orthodox Church, and I've seen this in interviews with church prelates over the past 2 years, they have been disturbed by the incursions of Western televangelists and by their experienced use of the media. And I believe that this church, this large structure, is not only a political symbol or a cultural symbol, but also is there to give the church a modern center of enormous size, as other faiths now possess, to propagate the spirit of Russian Orthodoxy, so that it will be technologically equipped mm-hmm. as well as large. From the outside, it will look like a historical monument.
But it'll be new inside.
Yes, a part of the church's campaign to continue its resurrection in the 21st century.
The thing that strikes me as odd, almost unbelievable in this description, Bill, that you're offering about the rebuilding of this cathedral is that my impression watching the television news in the evening is that there's a sort of cultural chaos mm-hmm. in contemporary Russia. It just astounds me that there could be enough concentrated effort mm-hmm. to pull this project off, given the mm-hmm. tug of war that's going on
yes.
in that country. How about
yes.
this?
Well, I think it is indeed a tug of war, and we're now seeing that very clearly. There is massive discontent in the country over the pace and progress of reform and their economic impact, particularly in the provinces, which have not benefited as much as the major cities have from these changes. I think that discontent has been expressed in the recent elections to the Duma, or parliament, particularly in the success of the communist bloc, the Zhirinovsky bloc. As long as that discontent is being expressed through the voting booth, then I think the system still has a chance of surviving.
Now, you have a sense of this because you have traveled, you've been not only in Moscow recently, mm-hmm. but tell us very briefly about your forays into the northern part of Russia.
Well, I think there you see not only areas of vast beauty, but also of great economic depression. This has been an area in the far north. By that, I mean the area above Yaroslavl, anywhere from 200 to 800 miles north of Moscow in the direction of Arkhangelsk, their port on the White Sea. And I think there's been a widespread economic depression there for many decades. And they're hanging on, but life is very difficult there, and villages are being depopulated because people can no longer sustain life in these areas. But the church has come back to this area, which was a center of monasticism in Muscovy, in medieval Russia, in the 15th and 16th and 17th centuries, mm-hmm. When these monasteries were founded by pioneer monks and abbots who went to the far north. And those monasteries are still there, solidly built, and a number of them have been reclaimed. They are now being restored with remarkable results. And in some cases, such as the Fieropontov Monastery, in the far north, the monasteries are actually once again becoming centers of learning, which was one of their roles in the Middle Ages.
Now, I remember at a recent conference here at the National Humanities Center, Bill, I believe it might have been Connor Cruz O'Brien, the statesman, it might have been Mr. Billington, the Librarian of Congress, who himself knows a lot about Russian mm-hmm. history, pointing out the paradox of the rise of religion again in modern Russia as a good thing, bad thing, in the sense that, in a way, it helps to inspire the darker forces of nationalism that everybody worries about. Yeah. Now, we want to look at Russian churches and say, here's a good spiritual thing going on in this terribly troubled part of the world. On the other side of the coin, you've got this issue of nationalism, not to mention the ethnic conflicts that accompany the expression of Russian religious belief. Comment on this for us.
Well, I'm not sure that at this point there are any ethnic conflicts directly related to the revival of the Russian Orthodox Church, but I think one has to bear in mind that the church itself is a large and immensely complex institution. There are many factions within it, and I would not want to define the church in any one direction. I think there is a positive role that the church has to play and is playing in the defining of Russian identity, but it should not be an exclusive role. That would be the path, once again, to disaster. This is just my view as an outsider, but I think the role of the church in reclaiming parish buildings, restoring them to use, once you see that directly, if you travel out in the countryside, is a remarkable, indeed I would say miraculous, resurrection.
William Brumfield is a professor of Slavic studies at Tulane University. His book, Lost Russia, Photographing the Ruins of Russian Architecture, is available from Duke University Press. In the category of illustrated books, Lost Russia was a 1996 winner at the Book and Journal Show of the Association of American University Presses. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Russian history and culture continues. I'll talk now with Louise McReynolds of the University of Hawaii. She says that in their attempts to explain Russia's development, historians have traditionally drawn upon one of two principal interpretive strategies, Marxism and modernization. These are important, to be sure, but according to Louise McReynolds, political and economic paradigms often overlook insights available through attention to cultural forces, such as commercialization, the growth of the press, and leisure time activities. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Louise McReynolds worked on a new study of the rise of the middle class in late imperial Russia.
Most people don't think of Russia as having a middle class. They associate it with Russia with the peasants and the nobility. But when, following the great reforms of the 1860s that began with the emancipation of the serfs, the czars made a commitment to industrialize the country. And that meant the creation of different kinds of jobs. That meant that, you know, the creation of, we know that the working class came from that. Uh-huh. But in addition to the working class, we had all those professionals, factory managers, business people, people who continued to work for the government bureaucracy, mm-hmm. but that we would nevertheless consider a middle class somewhere between the czar and the nobility and the peasantry. It's the very common triangulation that you have of Russian history, mm-hmm. but that has to do with the way in which Russia has traditionally been studied.
And you're not looking at
it. And that's
in
what
those
I'm not
terms.
Looking at, because we start with we in the United States, well, we everywhere generally mm-hmm. who are studying Russian history start with 1917. Look back to try to explain that. Focus on the members of the intelligentsia mm-hmm. who led the revolution, who were the most influential in developing policies,
right.
You know, the revolutionary policies, and who set up the structure, the ideological structure, after 1917, and of course the peasants who were the big participators. But in more contemporary studies of social change in Russia, we see the flowering of these other social and commercial elements, mm-hmm. people who were involved with the development, I was talking about industrialization earlier, the development of commerce, the development of commercial culture, mm-hmm. ideas of consumerism. Mm-hmm. These are people who were held in great contempt by the intelligentsia. Their world was destroyed in 1917. When I say destroyed, I mean their films were burned, their books were burned. There was an attempt to physically annihilate the aspects of this culture. Their mm-hmm. newspapers were closed, and so they've been washed out of most of what we know about Russian history.
You have a story about a man, a family by the name of Suvorin. Why is this important to you? Tell me a quick story.
It's extremely important because the way in which he represented, through him and his family and his father down through his sons, so much of social, economic, and political change in Tsarist Russia. Beginning with his father, who was a peasant soldier at the Battle of Borodino. War and Peace,
right.
Yes. Who served with incredible bravery and therefore was awarded hereditary noble status. Mm-hmm. So the family has entrance into society that, even though it doesn't have the money yet, it has the access that would be denied so many other Russians.
Well, now, as I understand the story of this man and this family, the Suvorins, what's going on here is a cultural story that, for you as a professional historian, has large political implications. They sort of act on one another. Am I right about this?
Yes, very much so, because Suvorin, as a young man, became a member of the radical intelligentsia. That is, he was very concerned with it's too premature to be saying a violent overthrow of the Tsarist government, uh-huh. but definitely committed to some kind of substantive political change. As he grew older, he became more conservative, and he became publisher of what became one of the, for a while it was the largest, and certainly one of the most influential nationally, newspapers in the country. So he was a pioneer in communications. He was a pioneer in styles of reporting. Then he became a pioneer in book publishing. He was the one who introduced Pushkin at cheap prices, which meant that for a ruble, anybody can have the collected works of Pushkin.
Uh-huh.
So he made this available. He was publisher of a journal, the Historical Herald, the purpose of which was to make Russian history available on a mass scale to readers.
And this business of a mass press, and again, the story of the Suvorin family, this goes, in your argument, to the creation of what we in the United States would call the middle class.
Absolutely, absolutely. The two are intricately intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
What you have developing in both, in anywhere really, with a middle class is media of communications that are subsidized by commercial endeavors. When I'm talking about a mass press in Russia, mm-hmm. I'm not talking about the printing of revolutionary leaflets. I'm talking about advertising supporting the supporting a large newspaper industry. Mm-hmm. And you do have this in Russia.
Well, when you talk about non-political communication, you are approaching the threshold of another one of the
key
elements in your argument here, and that would be the notion of leisure. Mm-hmm. And that is to say, what happens to people when they're not at work? We don't want to trivialize this,
mm-hmm.
but leisure is nonetheless very important to your view of this development of the Russian middle class. Explain this.
Sure. Leisure, when I use the word leisure and I talk about leisure time activities, I'm not simply talking about time, empty time that you're not at work. I'm talking about what you do with that time that you understand to be somehow transformative. Mm-hmm. Entertainment, we don't just seek out entertainment to escape from the harshness of the real job. Even if what we do want to do is escape from the harshness of the real world, we make choices.
It's not a vacuum,
in
other words.
It's not some
empty space that mm-hmm. has no social or personal meaning to us.
This is what I'm looking for in leisure time activities, mm-hmm. is what kinds of purpose they were looking for in their lives, what they wanted to do with themselves in time that they were not spent at work.
Well, if we were to make some arbitrary divisions, lines of limitation, inclusion, exclusion, we could talk about politics,
mm-hmm.
we could talk about the life of the spirit, spirituality and religion, and
mm-hmm.
then we could come into this large sort of malleable and amorphous area that you were describing, namely leisure time activities. I take it that took the form of what? Sports?
Sports is very big. I'm working on a chapter on sports.
Uh-huh.
The theater, vaudeville, reading novels, obviously, this is before television.
Mm-hmm.
Tourism.
Mm-hmm. Louise, why is it that looking at something like leisure time activities or the use, the abuses, censorship, the presence of a mass media, for example, print media in pre-revolutionary Russia, why is it that has somehow now taken on a legitimacy as a way into the analysis of Russian culture for scholars? Is it to the exclusion of political history and economic history?
Oh, heavens no. And in fact, I'm one of the few people who are working in this opening field,
uh-huh.
of middle-class, middle-brow Russian culture. Certainly nothing is going to replace politics or the economy.
It's what, just looking from a slightly different point of emphasis,
yeah.
the tone of things has changed some?
The tone of things has had to change, and Russian history as a profession obviously had to go through some kind of self-searching after 1991 with the collapse of communism. We had to go back and start asking other questions about Russian society in 1917.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where culture comes in. That's where this middle class, because if you've got this paradigm of haves and have-nots, then it works really well to say, well, they just collapsed and the have-nots mm-hmm. took over. If you've got this much more complicated picture with a substantive middle class, with people who had commercial values, with people who wanted to own their own property, their little houses or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and if this is vital in Russian history, then you're going to end up with a slightly different picture of 1917, a more complicated picture,
mm-hmm.
but something that really needs to be explained.
Now, where do you look for evidence, Louise? I mean, do you argue this case that the middle class comes along and has an interplay with politics and religion and the press? Do you look at it in terms of history from the ground up, that is to say, individual nitty-gritty lives, or do you look, again, to go back to that political model, do you look from the top down? How does this work?
Well, I look in the middle.
The middle class.
The middle.
Fair enough.
I It's neither top-down, but it would be more bottom-up than top-down.
Mm-hmm.
But I look by watching their movies, by collecting copies of their plays and reading the plays, the kinds of plays that they were going to see.
And your professional colleagues in history don't look at you and say that you're trivializing the study because you're looking at these, elements in a minor key rather than the large political stories.
Somebody like myself has been accused of both. I've been praised for blazing trails, and I've been accused of trivializing.
Uh-huh.
I like to think of myself more as a trailblazer, but no, because it is this unknown, unresolved area of Russian history.
Louise McReynolds is a professor of history at the University of Hawaii. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, she worked on a study of pre-revolutionary Russian culture. Her previous work includes studies of the development of the mass circulation press and of the development of civil society and public culture in late imperial Russia. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light. We keep the lights on and more. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio cassette of this program. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Cassette tapes are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 817. That's $10. Program number 817. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. If you want more information about the National Humanities Center, write to us or call during business hours Eastern Time. Our phone number is 919-549-0661. That's area code 919-549-0661. The National Humanities Center is an independent nonprofit institute that seeks to encourage excellence in scholarship, strengthen teaching, and broaden public understanding of the humanities. Next week on Soundings, High Tech Democracy. In partnership with the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, Soundings will feature a conversation with David Lytell of the White House Office of Science and Technology. David Lytell will be here to talk about American politics in the age of digital communications. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.